Bob's putting out on the table the books. I failed to mention them. We ordered some last year, and they were all taken within a matter of a week, I guess. I ordered some more, and they've been sitting back there in boxes for several weeks. Some books and envelopes that go with them. J. Vernon McGee's book is The Cross is God's Christmas Tree, and He is Coming Again. If you would like to send these along with a card or just send this, it's an excellent way of sowing the seed here at Christmas time. So they're there for your taking, and most of them are on that table over there on my left and your right. So get those before you leave. Okay, let's look in John 18 and 19 this evening. John 18 and 19. I'm glad I'm up here. I can move around and get a little body heat going. The involvement of Pontius Pilate in the trial of Jesus Christ gives us an excellent opportunity to study this man. Study a man who is probably, of all the people in the arrest and trial of Christ, Herod, the Caiaphas, Annas, the soldiers, all these people who are involved, there is really only, Pontius Pilate is the modern man. He is like, so much like, the man of Western civilization. And so we have a good opportunity to get a psychological or spiritual profile of this man. Why does he behave the way he does? What makes him tick? And how is he like the modern man? Now, I've entitled this Pontius Pilate, the Cynic's Christmas. Well, Pontius Pilate didn't exactly celebrate Christmas, though he did in the Roman fashion. But yet, how do you think a Pontius Pilate type man would celebrate a Christmas season? I mean, what if he lived down the street from you? How do you think he'd celebrate Christmas? What kind of guy do you think he would be? I think we'll find out from this passage. We're going to look at him. And we're going to spend a little bit of time to get some background on Pontius Pilate. So let's go back in history for a little while, and let's try to put some things together and lead up to this man and his place in the trial of Christ. First of all, his name. What in the world does Pontius Pilate mean? As I told you this morning, he is not a pilot for Southern, for Piedmont, Eastern, or Delta. His name, we're making some guesses when we try to figure out what Pontius means. It's quite possible it's connected with the word bridge or the word fifth. I don't know that there was any significance in that. Possibly he is named Pontius because of his military exploits and success in the province of Pontus in Asia Minor. It's quite possible. His name Pilate perhaps may mean armed with a javelin. Apparently Pilate did have some military success because he moved up the ranks and he had an appointment as a procurator, which didn't come to just anyone. And he was given this perhaps because of his military success. He was a Roman citizen. He was born in Italy. We don't know the date or the place of his birth. He was married to one Claudia Procula. You meet her in Matthew 27 and verse 19 by way of her dream. You may remember she had a dream about Christ. Apparently she and her husband had been talking about this Christ. He had at least gotten their attention and stimulated their curiosity. Pontius Pilate was the fifth procurator or government representative that Rome sent to the province of Judea. Now, there had been five. There had been Caponius. There had been Ambivius, Rufus, one Valerius Gratus, and then in the year 26 AD, Pontius Pilate was appointed procurator, and he lasted the longest of any of his predecessors. He was the procurator for the province of Judea for 10 years, from 26 AD to 36 AD. if we can, you know, the only way we know anything about Pilate really outside the Bible is we have two sources, a man by the name of Philo, who was no love lost on his part for Pilate. It's a little hard to get much real truth about Pilate from him. He's so vindictive, invective against him. And he, the other source is Josephus. So what apparently was the background of Pilate was that being appointed procurator by Tiberius, he must have had some skills that Tiberius saw, military skills, some strength in being able to handle people. He came up through the ranks. He was what is known as from the equestrian rank, or a knight. He was a middle class kind of man. He, in other words, he wasn't born into nobility. And so what he did achieve, he must have achieved by some successes, personal initiative. He wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. And so as some kind of a reward, though I'm not sure if Pontius Pilate would have looked on this as a reward, but it was the best you could do, middle class kind of man, getting this province over which you have almost total authority. You see, Pontius Pilate was put over Judea, which included Samaria. It included all areas down to the, through the Dead Sea area, over to Gaza. And he had absolute authority over everybody in this province, except for Roman citizens. He could pass life or death sentences. But he had a very difficult task. He had to keep the Jews happy. He had to keep Tiberius happy. And he had to keep himself in power. Now, that was no easy task. And so here we meet this man, Pontius Pilate. He was given responsibility over 2,500 to 5,000 troops as an occupying army, about 120 cavalry. He lived in Caesarea. I can see why he would have preferred to live in Caesarea. Caesarea is on the coast. It's moderate in the wintertime. It is rather pleasant in the summertime. And the city was built. Herod the Great had a good deal to do with building this wonderful seaside city up on the coast. And this is where Pontius Pilate's headquarters were. At the time of a feast, Pontius Pilate came down to Jerusalem. He brought some troops with him. Of course, there were troops that were bivouacked here at the barracks, the Mark Antony barracks, right next to the temple. And so Pontius Pilate came to the feast because of the number of Jews who came into the city. And it was his responsibility to look over the situation, keep his eyes on the, or keep the pulse of what may be going on, possible insurrection, trouble. Pontius Pilate never seemed to really understand the Jew. He was a typical Roman in his attitude toward the Jews. He was stubborn himself, and he looked upon the Jew as being unnecessarily unbending. The Jew would not accept, would not be tolerant of other religions, and would not compromise, except for those Sadducees, those Jews who didn't believe all that much, really, who were just the consummate politicians in Israel. But apart from those, Pilate didn't really understand the Jews. Now, when Pilate came to Judea in 26 AD, he didn't get off to a very good start. There were three incidents that marked Pilate and really showed his attitude toward the Jew. We'll call the first one the shield incident. He had brought into the city gold shields, and they were placed in Herod's palace. Now, there were apparently no images on these shields, but there were inscriptions, something to the effect of recognizing who the procurator was, and also who the emperor was, Tiberius, at that time, with possibly some representation of Emperor Tiberius. Well, that made the Jews mad. There was a great demonstration. Thousands of people came out in the streets, and had its effect. And Pontius Pilate pulled back these shields and had them taken back up to Caesarea, out of Jerusalem, where it offended the Jews, and had them taken back up to the city of Caesarea. Then there was another incident. The next incident we'll call the Standards incident. Now, the Standards incident was a little more flagrant. Now, Pontius Pilate, when he brought his a detachment of troops down from Caesarea into Jerusalem, when he took over the reins of rule, he brought a detachment of troops into the city, brought them in at night, but they came in with these banners, the standards. You know, you can imagine troops coming in, foot horsemen and infantrymen, and naturally you're going to have standard bearers and these flags that are identifying them, what detachment, and here is the representatives of Rome. And on these banners, there were images of the emperor, bringing them into Jerusalem. Now, the Jews were very sensitive to any kind of image, any kind of image. And bringing it into the city of Jerusalem was an insult. It was more than an insult. It was sacrilege to these Jews. And they really got hot. They demonstrated. Thousands of people, people even came from the countryside and came into the city and were protesting. And Pontius Pilate was aggravated but refused to do anything about it. He went back up to Caesarea, where they followed him up there by the thousands, protesting what he had done. This is the first record, I guess, first event on record of civil disobedience. Because for 5 days and nights, people prostrated themselves out and camped out around his house. For 5 days and nights, he couldn't go out of his house without stepping over bodies. People just sleeping and standing around and protesting. And so he said, well, I'm going to do something about this. So he called a meeting over here at the amphitheater in Caesarea. And everybody thought that he was going to bring some just resolve this problem. And he got him over there and began to make his speech, but then he had his troops move in around them and they arrested them. So that took care of that incident, at least as far as Pontius Pilate was concerned. Then there was another incident. We call this the aqueduct incident. Pontius Pilate did have access to the temple treasury. He had actually a couple of things that he could do that he had a lot of inflow, or at least a lot of power over Judaism. He had the sole right to pass on capital punishment. If the death penalty was to be used, he was the one who had to give the okay. He was the administrative head. He appointed the high priest in Jerusalem for Israel. He was in charge of the priestly vestments, which were kept in the Mark Antony barracks right next to the temple. So when the priests would come to wear these vestments to go through the offerings at the feast and Passover, they would come through Pilate and would get these and put them on. But it also meant that Pontius Pilate had access to the temple treasury. So he took money from that to build an aqueduct to bring water from about 25 miles south of Jerusalem, bring it into the city, into the temple area. He took temple treasury money to do it. Well, that did it. Because this money was korbanos, korband. That is, it was declared for money to be used to provide payment for the sacrifices and upkeep of the temple and all. And they wouldn't have anything to do with Pilate taking this money to build an aqueduct. So, another civil disobedience. And they were out in the streets and they were, you know, they were saying, lying down and they would come and rest them and put them in the paddy wagons and all this. But Pilate was a little more shrewd this time. What he did is he had many of his troops just dress up like ordinary folks. And they stood around in the crowd. They just kind of moved in. Here all these people are out here shouting, boo, boo on Pilate and all that. And down with Pilate. And so, meanwhile, the soldiers were moving in unnoticed, and they had, under their garments, they had some nice, good billy clubs. And then, at the right signal, they let loose on all these Jews who were protesting. And so they just beat them to death. Hundreds and hundreds of them were slain, and the crowd obviously dispersed. And I think that ought to give you the impression that Pilate wasn't getting along too well with the Jews. The shields incident, the standards incident, and the aqueduct incident. Now, we're just about ready to look at Pilate in chapter 18 where he meets Christ. But let's be remember one thing. He's in Jerusalem just to keep an eye on things. There is a beefed up detachment of soldiers. Pilate is, he knows of Christ. He's heard of the people that talk of him. Apparently he's never met him because he seems to be interested. He is asking some questions. He doesn't get the kind of answers that I think he wanted. Now, let's look. Let's do this. Let's just look down through some of these, the give and take right quickly. There are about 17 of these, but I won't try to run through all of them. But I just want to try to get you to get the feel for this give and take. Here it is in the Praetorium now. This is probably over on Zion Hill in Jerusalem, up at the palace. And he's brought into Pontius Pilate. Here is this Roman procurator. And here is Jesus Christ, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Let's pick it up. Let's listen. Let's listen at the door. The first encounter, verse 29, we see this. Pilate therefore went out to them and, listen to verse 28. This is ironic. They led Jesus therefore from Caiaphas into the Praetorium. It was early. This was about 6-7 o'clock in the morning. And they themselves did not enter into the Praetorium in order that they might not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. I mean, this really slays you. These men are so bent on getting Christ crucified and resorting to any illegality that they can, and they're filled up with envy, and they are murderers at heart. They hate Christ, and yet they're more concerned at this point about stepping in on Gentile pavement, lest they be ceremonially declared unclean, and then they can't eat in the Passover. What a shape of values. Pilate, therefore, went out to them. Now, what do you think this Roman must have thought? Well, he's probably these hard-headed Jews. I'd like to knock these guys' head. What accusation do you bring against this man? They answered and said, well, if this man's an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you. So the first encounter is he's just following through routine Roman law. Okay, what do you want me to do? Now, look down at verse 31. Let's fly through some of these quickly. What does he want to do? He wants to send him over to Herod. He'd like to do that. Luke gives that account. He wants to pass the buck. And he said, take him yourselves. You judge him according to your law. I don't want anything to do with this. Verse 37, he didn't even want to argue about something that Pilate therefore said, so you're a king. I frankly think that Pilate, as you look through this, Pilate was, he couldn't believe it. I mean, he's not used to kings coming across this way. I mean, Pilate has been in the very presence of the emperor of the Roman Empire. He's seen all the pomp and pageantry, the colors and the sound and the light and all of this. And look who's standing before him. Probably by this time a rather drawn out, tired man, but a man with great dignity in his presence. And so he says, so you're the king of the Jews. You? I'm not used to seeing kings that look like that. And Jesus said, you said correctly that I'm a king. Now, there is something in verse 38 that I'm really interested in. I want to come back to that. Look what Jesus said at the end, in verse 37. For this I have been born. You say correctly, I'm a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. Now, the cynic answers. Pilate said to him, what is truth? And he walks away. And Pilate's not asking this for information. He doesn't pull up a chair and sit down and wait for a doctrinal dissertation. He doesn't believe Christ has any truth to offer. You know why? Because Pilate is a cynic. He doesn't believe you can come to that answer to that question. I want to come back to that. Well, let's look at some of the other things that happened. Verse 1 of chapter 19, Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him. I think what he's doing here is he's trying to get the sympathy of the crowd. If they could just see Christ being beaten and bleeding and realize, stop. This is enough. We don't have anything on this man. We don't want you to go through with it. And it didn't work. They were really bent on seeing Christ nailed to the tree. Then you'll notice down in verse 4, Pilate came out again and said to them, behold, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him. Notice how often he says that. Verse 38, he said, I find no guilt in him. Verse 4, he's saying that. Verse 6, he said, take him yourselves, crucify him, for I find no guilt in him. Pilate was convinced that this man was not guilty of any crime, whereby he could come under the penalty of death. Pilate was convinced of that. Verse 8, Pilate therefore heard this statement. He was more afraid. More afraid what? Look what he says. We have a law that by the law, because he made himself out to be the Son of God. Son of God. See, that shook him up. Do you know why? Because Pilate, when he heard them say that they said Jesus was the Son of God, Pilate responded to that as a typical Roman. For the Romans knew or believed that the gods consorted with humans, and that sometimes the gods and mortals would have children. They would be demigods. They would be part human, part god, like a Hercules. And I guess when they said he's the Son of God, he thought, Son of the gods, what have I got here? I mean, he was enough of a religious man, a Roman religious kind of man. He's enough superstition in him to think, I better be careful with this. See, it shook him up. He came and he said to Jesus, he wants to know, where are you from? Did you come from Mount Olympus? Are you like Hercules, one of the gods? And Jesus didn't answer it. Jesus was not about to deal in trifling things at that point. And Pilate therefore said to him, you do not speak to me. Do you not know that I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you? I mean, this is the man that had surrounded the folks up there at Caesarea, thrown them in prison, sent troops in among the people in Jerusalem, beat them over the head with billy clubs. This is the man that had absolute power over all the subjects in the province of Judea. Don't you know I have this power? Jesus said, you wouldn't have it unless God gave it to you. Well, we'll come on down and let's get this to a close, this part of it. As a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release him, but the Jews wouldn't let him. Pilate comes through as weak. It's surprising, but he's really weak. He's so interested in doing what's expedient that he's willing to surrender an innocent man to crucifixion because he's trying to please the Jews. And when they mention the fact that Jesus was guilty of insurrection and that he was a king, naturally that got Pilate's ear. It was the last thing he wanted to happen was word to get to Tiberius that he was letting a man off the hook who was going around this province stirring up the Jews saying that he was a king. And Tiberius was not known for his patience, and that would be the end of Pilate. So he's got to do something, though he's convinced that Jesus is not guilty of a crime. Well, Pilate does get in the last lick against the Jews. He very sarcastically, very cynically does this. He wrote an inscription. I'm looking at 19 of chapter 19. He wrote an inscription and put it on the cross, and it was written, Jesus the Nazarene, the King of the Jews. He's trying to insult them. King? You don't ordinarily see kings hanging as a common criminal. That's not the posture of a king. He gets the last stab at the Jews. Now, I want to come back to that statement. He said, what is truth? And let's look at that statement and let's take his soul And let's just turn it inside out for a minute and see what possessed him to say that and what was behind that kind of statement. You need to remember this, that Pilate, probably trained, educated in Rome, had the legacy of Greek philosophy. The Romans respected the Greeks for this fact that the Greeks had made a contribution. Plato and Socrates. These men had grappled with a question of what is truth? I mean, that's the indoor sport of the philosopher, isn't it? What is truth? Plato had struggled with this question himself. And he would struggle through it like with all the particulars, that is all the things, ideas, all these things there are. But yet, how do you get to some universal thing that can pull it all together? What one, if you got an idea of goodness, where's the idea of goodness come from? Would you say, well, we thought it. Well, why did we think it? And so what these philosophers did was they just tried to go back and back and back and back. What they're trying to do is answer the big questions. Who are we? Where we come from? Where are we going? The universal. Something to pull everything together and give all the details of life meaning. They gave up. I believe it was Socrates himself who said something to the effect that perhaps one will come who will do this. I'm paraphrasing, but one will come who will pull it all together and in himself will embody the universal. That's interesting. I don't think he knew what he was saying, how eventually one did 300 years later. But what happened with Greek philosophy is that it just went to seed. You had people who came with, you've heard the Stoics. You've heard of the Stoics, that philosophical school. And it was kind of a grin and bear it approach. Just, you can't get any universal sense out of it all. Just grin and bear it. The Epicureans just said, if it feels good, do it. The mystery religions, well, just take the big leap of faith and hold on and hope that when you leap out there, you can find something to hold on to, find some meaning in life. Pilate knew all that. And you know what? Pilate realized the absolute bankruptcy of Greek philosophy to answer the question, what is truth? The greatest minds of men to that time had come to what conclusion about truth? I don't know. You see why Pilate says that? He says, what is it? Because he's a cynic. And here's what a cynic is. Pilate was disillusioned with philosophy. A cynic is a person who's inclined to believe that the motives of people and their actions are insincere. Doubting goodness. Doubting the fact that when a person does a kind thing, thinking that they're not really doing it for the helpfulness of this to someone else, but they've got some ulterior, mean motive. That's a cynic. Pilate was a cynic in that he doubted the ability of Christ to have the answer to this issue of what is truth. You can't tell me what truth is, he said. Nobody knows. Forget it. He was disillusioned. And disillusionment and cynicism marked Pilate as a typical modern man. Let me show you this. Here's what I mean. Is that this kind of attitude is exactly the way our Western civilization has come to approach the issue of truth. A man by the name of Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. You've heard of Hegel? 1770 to 1831. He approached the subject of truth. This is the way he did. He said, this is the way you determine truth. You've got thesis and antithesis. That is, what happens is that you have a statement of what is truth, and then you have a reaction to that, and then when the two clash, you get what is called synthesis. And so how truth is developed is the way history truth, then, is whatever is acceptable at any point in time in history. History, the development of history determines what is truth. In other words, it's totally subjective. It's totally subjective. Now, Hegel made that, I don't know, you want to call it a contribution, but anyway, it's certainly a school of thought that's followed. And it's this concept, it's the functionalist view of truth. We would call it utilitarianism. This is what I mean. It's the idea that, for instance, if everybody does something, if a majority of people accept something, that's truth. Listen, don't you see that? Isn't it true in our society what's happening? Isn't this the way truth is decided upon? We're poll crazy. What is the consensus about, say, let's pick something out. What is the consensus about abortion? The pro-abortionists say most people want it legalized. Therefore, it would be right, simply this is what most people want. So you have this utilitarian approach to truth. And here's how it works also. People say, oh, it's growing fast. It's successful. It must be right. I heard a preacher who espoused this very philosophy on his own program. He was tooting his own horn. And he was describing how people from all over the world had come to a pastor's conference at their church. And they had pastors from all over the United States and all the world. And their parking lot was full of cars. And he was saying, it's working. What do you got? Are you a successful? Let me tell you something. Do you determine what's right by how many cars in the parking lot? Do you determine what's right by what's apparently successful? I'll tell you, evangelical Christianity is guilty of this more than we realize. Just because something is growing, just because something is apparently successful, is not the means of measuring truth, whether it's right or wrong. Or it may even be this. Does it work? If it works, it must be right. Not necessarily. Let me show you some ways in which I think this can happen at Christmas time. Let's get Pilate in for a Christmas party. You see, the cynic at Christmas and this approach to truth at Christmas is in this fashion. People want the feelings, but they could care less about the facts. Over the spirit of Christmas. They will be perfectly willing to get good feelings, good vibes from listening to the Messiah, but totally reject the facts of the incarnation. Or the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra is going to present the Messiah. It'll be presented all over this town. I wonder how many people who listen to the Messiah and who will be moved emotionally by it know the Messiah in a personal way and are committed to the truths of biblical Christianity. You see, people are willing to live with the feeling without any concern for the facts. That's the dilemma we're in. That's the disillusionment. That's why so many people are in despair. They're ready to shuck the whole thing. But they want the feelings. Let's go back to Christmas. People who want to give and get, but could care less about the giver. We talk about the spirit of Santa Claus. And people get almost, they get sickening at the way they talk about this kind of thing. And the spirit of giving and giving to one another. You can't really talk about the true meaning of giving unless you understand that God's unspeakable gift, Jesus Christ. It's impossible. And by the way, I heard, and this might be interesting, this has been a lot of heavy philosophy, but do you know what Santa's calling the elves? Did you know their name? His helpers, you know, work with him in the workshop and all. His little, you know, the little people, those are subordinate clauses. Okay. Okay, back to Pilate and Christmas here. People want peace. They want peace without the Prince of Peace. You see, what I'm trying to get is that here are people, here's a condition, an approach to truth, which people will place more emphasis on mission than the message. There'll be those who are more interested in feelings than facts. They will have an approach to morality which is, they want to legalize immorality. Do you know why these are happening? These things happen. It's because Pilate is alive and well in terms of his attitude toward truth. What is truth? Can't find it. Now I want to take you, in closing, to verse 37. Look what Jesus said. All right. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to witness to the truth, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. Beloved, is it possible to know that there is truth? There is. And this verse reveals four things about truth. One, truth is an entity. It is something. He says, the truth. Jesus Christ said this. Truth holds together everything. The nature of God, and that's related to the structure of the atom. If I could draw a big circle, and here we have the nature of the atom. We have a multiplication table. We have the nature of God. We have the inspiration and inerrancy of Scripture. Truth is an entity. Colossians 1:17 says that He, Jesus Christ, holds it all together. So we look at the fact that truth is an entity. It's not something that you grasp for. Secondly, truth is objective. It's not subjective. That truth is not something measured by my feelings. It is something that's measured out by the fact. Look what Jesus said in verse 37, to bear witness, martureo. Our word martyr comes from this word. It means to verbally bear witness to facts. If truth can be observed, it can be discussed. That's why we look at Christmas time with real significance. Why? We don't look at all of the, we aren't really taken as Christians by all of the superficial things of Christmas. We see that this really, the true meaning of Christmas is based on facts, objective facts. We measure truth not by ourselves, but by a record, the Word of God. The third feature of truth is this, in this verse, verse 37, is that truth is from above. Brings it all together. He's saying, I bear witness, I came into the world. So truth comes to us by revelation. It comes by the gift of God intervening into human affairs and giving us what we don't have in ourselves. It takes revelation to help us to understand, to come to a knowledge of truth. And then there's a fourth feature of truth in this verse, verse 37. Truth is found in a person. Jesus Christ said, I bear witness. Yes. He had already said, John 14:6, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh to the Father but by me. You know, Pilate had a wonderful opportunity right at that moment when he said, what is truth? Who was standing in front of him? Jesus Christ, the truth from the Father, a reality, objective, one who could be observed, one who would be believed, who could be believed. But do you know how Pilate treated him? He treated Jesus Christ as a mere trifle. Just something to get out of the way so he could go on about his routine. He treated Christ as a trifle and spends an eternity in hell because he treated Christ as a mere trifle. Something inconsequential, something unimportant. That was the cynic's approach to Christmas. That all he was concerned with was getting on with his feelings and ignoring the person of Christ. And my friend, If you try to go through the Christmas season only concerned with your feelings and your responses to lights and trees and to all of the trappings of Christmas, without a personal knowledge and a walking, living relationship with Christ, you're in no better condition than Pilate. Pilate walked out on the truth, walked away from it. Tradition says Pilate was called back to Rome. A problem. The Mount Gerizim incident. This did happen. The Jews had gotten word that some teacher told them that the golden utensils from the temple, that they were up on Mount Gerizim. And thousands of Jews went up there and were ready to go up to Mount Gerizim, up on top, for this big treasure hunt. Pilate got nervous, sent his troops in. Thousands were killed. They complained to the next man up above Pilate. Tiberius called him home. On his way there, Tiberius died. Tradition tells us that Pilate, having fallen out of favor with the emperor, committed suicide. Let's close in prayer. Father, deliver us from cynicism. Our day is one that wants the feelings without the facts. It wants Lord, we don't want to enter into that kind of thing. Dear God, use us to be really aggressive with the truth of the incarnation of Christ at this season in a special way. We'll be faithful sowers of the seed that Jesus Christ is the truth. And there is no other way to you but by Him. We thank you for that in Christ's name. Amen. Don't forget to pick up your books in the back.